we thought it was a good thing to provide some different alternatives for economic development. So it is disappointing, but I think we still have some sites to work with.
Changes are made to the Sea Alaska Land Selection Bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 2nd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Arctic people gather in Greenland for the Inuit Circumpolar Council.
Hunters are seeing significant changes in the behavior of sea mammals.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
Former Eagle River Representative Nancy Dahlstrom has resigned from her new job with the Parnell administration. Parnell says he did not ask her to step down as his senior advisor for military affairs, but that her decision came after the Department of Law changed an opinion, originally saying her newly created position was within the spirit of the state constitution. The issue revolves around the constitutional provision that prohibits a legislator from taking a position on which he or she might have voted while a member of the legislature. Dahlstrom had resigned before the position was created. Attorney General Dan Sullivan originally advised that since there was no position until after the resignation, the prohibition did not affect Dahlstrom and was not a factor. But Parnell says a more recent review determined that a court might see it differently.
The creation of these positions has taken place for years. So across the last 50 years, governors have hired legislators for their expertise, for their ability in whatever area the governor summoned their competence in. That longstanding practice has been called into question now by this new legal memorandum.
Parnell says if he is reelected, he will not offer any future state jobs to legislators and that he will ask next year's legislature to define the limits of the constitutional ban. Attorney General Sullivan says the second, more thorough review found no similar situation in statute or case law in any other state or within the federal system. However, the state Supreme Court has ruled that the purpose of the Constitution's ineligibility clause is to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Sullivan said there is a risk that the court would not support the earlier opinion. He says throughout the entire process, the governor, his staff, and former Representative Dahlstrom herself have followed the advice of the Department of Law.
We gave them the best advice we knew at the time, and we are now revising that advice. And I just want to mention that we take, the Department of Law, me as the Attorney General, take full responsibility for that. Any mistakes that have been done throughout this process, sole mistakes that have been done, have been through the Department of Law, and I apologize for that. I'll just leave it at that.
Parnell last fall used the same historical precedent to hire former Senator Gene Theriault to work as his senior policy advisor for in-state gas. He says he has not asked Theriault to resign and expects him to stay on the job. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski released changes to her Sea Alaska land selection legislation yesterday. The revisions are based on amendments that have been circulating among interest groups for weeks. But officials say more changes may be on the way. The changes shift some timber harvest areas away from northern Prince of Wales Island, and they remove 17 of 46 Native Futures sites. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
The original bill allowed Sea Alaska to select a significant amount of timberland on northern Prince of Wales Island. That drew opposition from the area's small communities, which hunt, fish, and conduct small-scale logging on some of the acreage. The revised measure shifts most harvest areas to other parts of the island, as well as remote islands to the west and north. Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon says those and other changes are an attempt at a compromise.
you're trying to resolve Sea Alaska shareholders' land claim, but you also realize fully that there are people that have lived there for a long time and that 40 years have gone by and that, you know, different interest groups have staked their interest in the area and you want to be responsive to their concerns.
Sea Alaska says the changes appear to keep the timber acreage the same, as well as the balance of old and second growth forest. Overall, the measure turns up to 85,000 acres of Tongass National Forest land over to the Southeast Regional Native Corporation. It would complete selections promised by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. In addition to timberland, the bill authorizes selection of what are called Native Futures sites. The Juneau-based corporation is concerned the revision drops 17 of those 46 properties.
Our hope was to provide different opportunities throughout the region for alternative economic development beyond timber and mineral development.
Jaylene Kukesharujo is Sea Alaska's general counsel.
We thought it was a good thing to provide some different alternatives for economic development. So it is disappointing, but I think we still have some sites to work with, and hopefully we're still going to be able to reach all of our communities in the region.
The legislation has faced opposition from environmental organizations. The revisions try to meet some of those concerns by setting aside 150,000 acres to offset logging impacts on Prince of Wales. The groups say that's not enough. They say it still allows too much logging and just shifts environmental impacts from one area to another.
Overall, we still think the proposal provides a solution for a single stakeholder and doesn't go far enough to mitigate the concerns that we had.
Lori Cooper is Rainforest Program Director at the Juneau Office of the Alaska Wilderness League.
In an island like Prince of Wales, where the impacts have already been so high, there's a much higher level of scrutiny of what more intensive logging would mean in a more focused area, which is what Sea Alaska is proposing.
I'm personally going to hold my nose and support the legislation.
Owen Graham is Executive Director of the Alaska Forest Association based in Ketchikan. He doesn't like the additional conservation areas.
To add a bunch more set-asides is silly. They're not big fisheries or wildlife areas. They're just another notch in the pistol for the conservationists. But if that's the price we have to pay to keep the jobs going, I guess it's a small price to pay, and we're willing to pay it.
He says the bill will keep Sea Alaska logging going while leaving enough Forest Service timber to support area mills. The revised bill is not the final measure to be presented to Congress. Murkowski spokesman Dillon says it was released to answer allegations it was being changed in secret. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
An aide to Alaska State Representative Mike Dugan says the Anchorage Democrat is recovering from a successful removal of a brain tumor. Aide Priya Keene says Thursday's surgery went well and that doctors were able to remove the entire tumor. Dugan's office disclosed earlier this week that the 62-year-old lawmaker would undergo the surgery in Seattle after a recent MRI revealed a tumor. Keene says Dugan's doctors believe his tumor was benign, but pathology reports are pending. There was no immediate word on when he'd be released from the hospital. The Inuit Circumpolar Council General Assembly wrapped up yesterday in Nuuk, Greenland. The 66 delegates from Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Chukotka adopted an ambitious plan called the Nuuk Declaration for the next 4 years. From member station KMBA, Jacqueline Estes has more.
The declaration adopted by delegates encourages greater involvement with international bodies such as the United Nations and the Organization of American States. Citing the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, it says free, prior, and informed consent is needed for development of resources. While the ICC normally meets every 4 years, the declaration calls for a summit on oil exploration and mining in the Arctic before then. Henrietta Rasmussen, Greenlandic journalist, describes issues raised by delegates. She says Lene Kielsen-Holm of ICC in Greenland told delegates hunters there have been seeing significant changes in the behavior of marine mammals.
Greenland has been experiencing some of the most traumatic impacts of climate change in the world. Holm says hunters are seeing significant changes in the behavior of sea mammals.
Minnie Gray of Canada and a member of the ICC Health Committee outlined gaps between the health of Inuit and non-Inuit in the Arctic. She pointed to differences in areas such as tuberculosis, sexually transmitted infections, suicide, injuries, and family violence. Rasmussen says Gray outlined four goals in a circumpolar health strategy.
Encourage greater focus by international, regional, and national policies. Improve awareness of Inuit health and wellness. Encourage greater focus by international organizations. Support better understanding by health professionals. And promote research to improve Inuit health.
Edna McLean, President Emeritus of Ilisagvig College in Barrow, talked about the sometimes devastating effects of changes such as loss of language and alcoholism and drug abuse. Rasmussen says McLean told delegates the way children learn has changed as well.
Traditionally, our family members were our teachers, mentors, and role models. You had to learn the lessons well if you wanted to survive in the Arctic. Each hunter became a scholar of the land and sea. Edna says, we need more Inuit teachers.
Delegates elected two Alaskans to the ICC Executive Council. Vera Metcalf is director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission based in Nome. Jimmy Stotts, formerly of Barrow, is executive director of ICC Alaska based in Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, moose turn up in strange places, but in a well?
Well, I better go check and see what's going on over there, because there's another one in a hole over there. And
that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. And by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine. Thanks to Alaskans like you, Tech Alaska can continue to deliver jobs and benefits for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com.
An Anchorage Superior Court has partially agreed with the Alaska Civil Liberties Union's claim that a bill that went into effect yesterday is unconstitutional. The bill sets limits on releasing criminals on bail while awaiting trial. While the court allowed most of the bill to stand, a statement from the ACLU says the court issued a temporary restraining order against one provision that kept those accused of domestic violence from their homes and businesses. That means the state may not enforce that portion of the new law. No statement was released by the Department of Law. Southeast salmon trawlers headed out yesterday for the first major king opener of the summer. The fleet is expected to target just over 78,000 kings in roughly 1 week of fishing. From Sitka, KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Patty Scannis, regional troll management biologist, says the Department of Fish and Game will shut down fishing by emergency order in 6 to 10 days. Scannis says she and other management staff will have a busy week.
We start tracking the catch on a daily basis. We receive fish tickets and they get entered every day. We get faxed or emailed king tallies from the processors around the region, and they give us their daily king tally, the number of kings they bought that day, and the number of landings. Another thing that we do is we do aerial surveys out of several different towns in Southeast, and we count troll vessels, we note their location, and then we compile all of that to get a total effort for the region.
Scannis adds that ADF&G has samplers in most ports who will interview fishermen to get an idea of the catch rate. That data is then folded into a formula to estimate the catch per boat per day, which should then give her a pretty good idea of how long the opener will go on. Southeast is the only region in the state with commercial salmon trolling. This year's preseason Chinook quota is the seventh lowest since the Pacific Salmon Treaty was signed in 1985. Scannis says 500 boats made landings in 8 weeks of spring Chinook fishing, which concluded on June 30th. The results were pretty much what she expected.
I'd say for the most part, the fishery was somewhat slower than a lot of years, and the catch right now, though, has bumped up quite a bit. It's up just over 27,000, and actually maybe close to 28,000 by the time we look at the report at the end of the day.
The spring harvest does have a bearing on the summer fishery. The Pacific Salmon Treaty with Canada allocates a total of just under 164,000 kings to the commercial troll fishery, and that accounting began in October of 2009 and ends in September of this year. The summer opener feels like the beginning of the season, but for management purposes, it's really the end.
So what we'll do is we'll continue to look at the number or the numbers of fish caught in spring based on our fish tickets, and we'll look at the hatchery component, and from that we'll come up with the number of treaty fish harvested in the spring fishery, and that will influence what is left for summer.
The good news for Southeast trollers is that despite facing the seventh lowest quota in 35 years, the Alaska hatchery component is ticking up 13% in the winter, which is about double last year, and a more typical 40% this spring. Alaska hatchery fish don't count against the treaty with Canada. Skanes is generally upbeat about the health of Chinook stocks in the region. The lower-than-average quota is only part biology. In 2008, the U.S. accepted a 15% harvest reduction when it renewed the salmon treaty. Skanes says this year's low quota is partly due to politics.
Whatever we would have got under the old treaty, we take that number and then 15% is taken off the top. So, you know, that's another reason that has nothing to do with the health of the stock.
Skanes says the department typically closes king trolling after reaching the initial target, requires everyone to unload, and then 2 days later reopens trolling to all species, including coho. Once managers get an idea of the strength of the coho run, usually by the first week of August, they'll order a trolling closure to allow cohos to escape into local rivers and streams. A number of Southeast communities take advantage of the closure for festivities of one kind or another. Intertidal golf tournaments have become popular. Then, usually in the latter half of August, trolling for kings will reopen with a target of around 30% of the commercial allocation. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Alaska is full of interesting animal stories. Hollywood is soon to begin filming the saga of three gray whales that were trapped under the ice in Barrow 2 decades ago. A backyard animal rescue drama this week in Anchorage may never get star-studded treatment, although a young calf moose in trouble got a reprieve thanks to fast work by state fish and game biologists and quick-thinking neighbors. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
After the winter snows melted at the end of April, I noticed a shallow depression about the size of a standard table platter at the very end of my backyard, underneath the windblown willow. The earth covering the depression was undisturbed, and I ignored it and let May grass grow thick over the tiny sinkhole. I thought I should get a pickaxe and dig to see what lay beneath, but I didn't, until this week. I was maneuvering through dense downtown traffic when I got the panic cell phone call. My husband said, "Come home right away. There's a moose in a hole in the backyard." I knew exactly what hole he meant.
Wow. If I could just get a rope up under his front haunches, you know?
It seems recent heavy rains in the city helped to destabilize the earth over the sinkhole. The yearling bull moose, browsing in willow trees, stepped onto the grass over the hole and fell 8 feet down into an old abandoned well. Fortunately for the moose, neighbor Bill Brownfield noticed the animal in trouble.
I saw him put his head up. There's a cow back here. It seems to me at least a year older. It could be a two-year-old cow that had this calf, you know, a year ago. She was over here eating, and I was just watching her, and I said, "Well, I better go check and see what's going on over there," because "There's another one in a hole over there." And
the moose was not injured, but would-be rescuers could not figure out just how to get him out of the well. He was in too deep to climb out by himself. What to do? Fish and game biologists Rick Sinnott and Jesse Coltrane responded to the call for help. Old-fashioned elbow grease turned out to be the remedy. Five shovels were rounded up and everyone pitched in to help dig around the perimeter of the hole to increase its size and lengthen it, while the soil falling downward piled up until the moose could just walk out by himself. With a little prompting, he figured out that's what we wanted him to do.
Come on, baby. Come on, baby.
Come on. There you go. There you go. Good job. Good job.
Good job. Good boy.
The calf scampered off, none the worse for his adventure. Later on, Mama Moose made her appearance, too, and all was well. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
When the massive earthquake devastated Haiti in January, Alaskan Krista Brelsford and her brother Julian were there at a friend's house that collapsed as they were running to get downstairs. Krista was trapped under debris and ultimately lost her right foot. She considers herself lucky, both because she says she was only trapped for an hour and because Haitians helped her brother free her. Her six-month recovery is a story of significant success. She started a foundation called Krista's Angels that has raised enough money to rebuild the school she and her brother were working at. And she is back to rock and ice climbing, as she had done in the past. She says she's been surprised at how easy it's been to adjust to an artificial limb.
And it's not that different than what I had to do when I was a kid. I'm just 25 now, doing it again. For example, I drive my manual stick shift car without any problems, without any adjustments. I met an amputee who said, oh yeah, I drive my pickup truck. I know another guy who's a commercial truck driver who's got missing both feet. It's different, but it's not any harder.
Have the doctors that you've been working with testing new technology with young people such as yourself who are wanting to do some pretty extreme things, such as rock climbing?
Actually, it's interesting. There's a guy, he's a professor of biomechanics at MIT. His name is Hugh Herr. And I think it was 1984, but in the early 80s, he lost both of his feet in a climbing accident at the age of 17. And he went on to college and became a really, really strong rock climber, and also developed really fantastic new prosthetics. So one of the prosthetics that he's developing right now is an ankle that a computerized ankle that adjusts to the slope of the ground you're walking on. It's not yet ready for release, but it sounds like it'll be a really cool technology when it's developed.
So it would be something closer to a natural bend in an ankle?
Yeah. So the way that I've been saying walking feels like, it feels like I'm wearing a downhill ski boot. Because the major joint that I don't have is an ankle. And the ankles that I, the feet that I'm using rely on springs rather than any computerized anything. So the more I try to bend my ankle forward, the more it resists backwards. Which, once I learned to deal with that, it's not that much of a challenge. But for people who are older or less active, they have a hard time with balance, they tend to have a much harder time with this, without the ankle. And for me, like when I'm out hiking and stuff on non-level ground and on climbing mountains and rocks and stuff, it would be nice to have an ankle that could adjust to the slope of the ground that I'm walking on.
Was there a point in those first few days when things were probably sort of bleak that you thought, man, I'm never going to be able to do what I love to do, rock climbing again? Or did you always just think, I'm going to go back and do this?
I pretty much always thought I'm going to go back and do this. I'd seen Hugh Herr, the guy I mentioned, I'd seen him climbing before, and I figured that if somebody could do it, I could do it. And then I also had vague memories of Oscar Pistorius, who's the runner who almost made it to the Olympics, who's got no feet. And I figured, if somebody can make it to the Olympics, this can't be that bad.
But what about the emotional toll? I would imagine that there has certainly been one. What has that been like, and how has it changed your perspective on life?
I have had to learn to deal with this. What the psychologists say, that losing a limb is a lot like losing a family member. You go through the same stages of grief, and I have. I'm real thankful for my family and Ethan, my fiance Ethan, that they've been there every step of the way, and they've taken really good care of me. So it's hard, but it's not nearly as hard as I would have thought going in.
And you've certainly been busy doing for others. Tell us about Krista's Angels and what's being accomplished in Haiti right now.
I'm actually really proud of that. And it's also been a really important part of my emotional recovery, that figuring out how to give back, how, you know, this is an experience I could have passed on, but I'm turning it into a positive aspect for something else, that there are a bunch of kids who are getting an education right now that if I weren't able to do this, they wouldn't. We've raised enough money to rebuild the Kabwa Community School, which Julian and I were working with. And so that was construction on that was just completed last week. The kids have been in class since early March under tents, and now they can start to go to school inside a building, which is pretty exciting. I also get to use my engineering skills I designed a rainwater harvesting system for the school in order to improve the quality of the water that they store there. So hopefully fewer kids will get sick when they drink it.
So what would you want people to know about your experience over the last 6 months, and what you hope to keep on doing for the people of Haiti?
I'm really proud of what we're doing, and I think it's really important to find people who are doing good work and support that. There are a lot of organizations that are doing a lot of good in Haiti right now. We're not the only one. The guys that we were working with in Haiti when we were there are basically what I would call unpaid social workers. They, for no reason other than that they want to make the world a better place, they spend all day, every day, working really hard to try and improve their own community. Four of the guys quit their jobs in order to raise money to build the Kabwa School the first time around. And then when they succeeded in that, but they couldn't find any money to pay any teachers, they continued to teach at the school, basically for free. They show up and from their homes with no electricity, no running water, in button-up T-shirts and nicely pressed pants, because that's the way that they think a teacher should dress, that they're just that committed to what they're doing.
Alaska, Krista Brelsford is a survivor of the Haitian earthquake. She'll be speaking about her experience tomorrow night in Anchorage at St. Mary's Episcopal Church. Links are at our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our stories, we're online at aprn.org. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.